Brian Beatty, I'm a drug addict. I guess we haven't really been praying any time, but Joe just reminded me that it doesn't hurt to say a prayer every now and then. So if we could just start off with the moment of silence, we'll say the serenity prayer real quick. Thank you. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Cool, thank you. Also kind of brings us back each time from a group or from a break. Everybody's kind of crazy after a break, and it's hard to get settled for a second. So thank you to everybody that's come up here and spoke, and it's just been an amazing thing already, and the speakers have been phenomenal. I had the honor of helping to pick out some of the guys and gals that we've had speak. So it's been exciting for me, because that's one of the things that really got me going, was listening to speaker tapes and then starting to go around different places in the country and get different vibes, I guess, from different places, but the same message, and just some of the craziest knuckleheads I've ever met. And when God gets a hold of us and things just change, you know, we just heard from Joe, what you know, from everybody, the miracles that happen. One thing that I've noticed in my life in the last few weeks, and it's funny, the 10th step again tonight, I guess Joe's loosely going to talk about that, but is I've heard over and over again, we don't know what the hell God is doing in our life. In my life, I just had an experience where I'm trying to make God do something in someone else's life, and I have no idea what it is. My job is to be there, do what I can for this person, and that's it, man. I don't know what else. I have no idea what God is doing. It took every drop of every single thing, every granule, every hit of crack, every shot of dev, every piece of pain and suffering, broken bones, broken hearts, everything to get me to where I was ready and willing to do this thing. So I was I got to travel a little bit in the last few years and go to some pretty amazing men's retreats around the country. And one of the first ones I went to was up in Nashville, outside of Nashville, called Usual Suspects. And I met Joe up there and a whole bunch of other guys. And I guess everybody thought I was with them because I was from Florida. And there's a whole bunch of guys from Florida that go to that. And I just fell in love with Joe and the whole group of guys. I was a year and a half sober. I felt like I knew all kinds of things, and felt, you know, once you recover, you feel like you learn some stuff. And then I start to find out that just continue to set these old ideas aside and watch these guys with many years that are able to continue to grow and carry the message and stay sober and stay happy for the most part. And Joe's just one of my best friends. I don't get to see him that often, but I love you, Joe. I'm so glad to have you, man.
All right, let's take a dinner break. I'm just going to listen tonight, okay? Hunter, take a picture so I can show my sponsor, because now I'm taking the jacket off. And loosening the tie. It's great to be here. I love our program of recovery. And thank you. Stay out of the pockets. And everybody lock their car. There's a lot of dope fiends around here, man. My name's Joe Krogan. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I love being sober today, and I love our program. I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. You had all the good speakers already. You had the good Joe right before this. And I heard the speakers were great all day, and so, you know, that's about to come to an end. Johnny this morning, and Ben, and two of my favorite guys, man. And if you don't have somebody in this program that you emulate, you won't grow. And I'm just following the men that went before me. Thank you for letting me be here and for the invitation to come here, and anybody who had anything to do with putting this on. And hopefully you'll take this back to your home groups and to the people you sponsor, and you'll make a change in your own area. Are there a lot of people from this area around here?
Yeah.
this is like my old stomping grounds here. I used to go, anybody ever heard of Avenue D? I was the mayor of Avenue D. I used to sell cars here in Fort Pierce, and I'd go into Avenue D dressed like this on Thursday night, because I got paid on Thursday, and come staggering out at the same clothes somewhere around Monday night or Tuesday. And that was a dark period. I heard they cleaned it up though, did they?
Yeah, it's real nice now.
Damn, I was going to go take a tour tonight. My sobriety date was 9 days ago, September 12th, 1990. It's no big deal. I was in a coma for 28 and a half years. The last 6 months have been a little tough, but I am blessed beyond my ability to be grateful, and you know, I'm supposed to talk a little bit about the step 10. I'm sure I might get there somehow before this is over. But, you know, and I got sober not far from here. I was in a Skid Row motel room on Powerline and Oakland Park Boulevard in Fort Lauderdale is when my last drink, where my last drink was. And I'm from South Florida, you know, for years. I'm not originally from South Florida, but I moved there when I was like 18 years old. And my home group is called Life's a Beach in Palm Coast, Florida. I came this morning from Asheville, North Carolina. We stay up there in the summertime, so I kind of zoomed in. I'm sorry I didn't get to hear all the speakers. I really am, but they have them recorded, so I'll listen to them on the way home. Does anybody like crack? Listen, I'm from South Beach. I lived in Miami. I moved to Miami in 1970. I invented the South Beach diet. Scotch and cocaine. Now, I hear they've changed it, but that was the South Beach diet. I was on that diet for a lot of years, man. And I'm not going to go into too much about how I got drunk and got high. I'm sure you've heard a ton of it this weekend. And I got here 5 days before my 40th birthday. September 12th was 5 days before my 40th birthday. I had never been to a treatment center, never been to a meeting, NA or AA, never been to a detox. I wish I would have known that there was these places that would, you know, drip dry, clean you up a little bit, feed you, spend 30 days, get back on your, you know, lube oil filter, rotate the tires, and send you back out for another 20K. But I didn't. You know, I didn't know those places. Thank God I didn't, because I might have died. I'm what they call, I think the book refers to it as a bitter ender. We had but two alternatives, go on to the bitter end, trying to blot out the consciousness of our intolerable existence as best we can. And that's what was going on in my life at the time. And it talks about, in our book, it talks about the different types of alcoholics and drug addicts. And I go to Alcoholics Anonymous because where I got sober, there was no other programs. I got sober and I got out of this treatment center in Miami, and I went where every good 40-year-old alcoholic goes. Mom, I'm home. And it was in Central Florida. It was a little town called Lady Lake, Florida. It's fondly known as hell. You got to be 1,000 years old to live in that county. It's in Lake County, Florida. It's not Florida. It's southern Georgia is what it is. It's the redneck capital of the world, and it's the retirement capital. Everybody is old. They got old, you know, trailer park communities, manufactured homes, you know, and I got out of treatment and I moved in there. And Joe was from that just spoke. Is Joe in here? There was a meeting. My sponsor, you know, lived next door to my mother, and that's how I got exposed to this thing. And he used to take me to a meeting in Ocala, and Ocala was like an hour away and an hour back, and he was so old, you know, I had to sit in the car and ride with him in his Buick. In Lake County, it's a law. You got to have a Buick, you know. It's like all old people drive Buicks or Crown Vicks. And he would take me to this meeting. The only way he could get me to go to this meeting in Ocala is he told me, he says, "Oh, man, you're going to love this meeting." He goes, there's a lot of ex-strippers there. I said, "Really?" He didn't tell me they were 80 years old. But when you're living in a place like that, they start to look good. "Hey, babe, want to go out for coffee?" "I'm buying." So anyway, I... You know, there's so much. You know, our stories, I've been around a little bit longer than most of you, so you can tell that. My home group, I said, was Life's a Beach in Palm Coast, Florida. I also have a home group up in North Carolina. But we have a men's meeting that I'm especially proud of, our Usual Suspects men's meeting. A lot of these guys over here are usual suspects in every sense of the word. Started that meeting. It's been going now for about 10 years. It's not even listed in the where and when. It started with five guys in the back of one of my offices, and we said, "Let's take each other through the steps." We wanted to catapult our recovery. It was about 10 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, and we took each other through the steps, and we had a spiritual awakening. Funny how that happens. Promised. I remember standing outside after the last meeting going, "Man, we don't want this to end. What should we do?" And we said, "How about if we do it again, go through the book again, and let's bring our sponsees in, and they can bring their sponsees in." And there are nights where there's 100 guys there, and most of them are under a year. And most of them are all young guys getting sober. And it's not even listed. It's not an invitation meeting. It's just an attraction meeting. It's more of a commitment. And I love that meeting. We have what we call a newcomer starter kit. Did I tell you about the newcomer starter kit? Because they're all so young, it's a flat brim cap, vape gun, energy drink, a phone with plenty of fish and Tinder already downloaded, and an unused big book. So we make these guys feel very welcome here. No offense if you got a flat brim cap or your vape gun. See, I'm from the old days. We used to smoke. We were real men. Man, if you can't laugh at yourself in this program, you're in real trouble. You're going to be in real trouble. But anyway, I don't remember a lot about September 12, 1990. And I'm not going to talk about the good years. You know, there were the good years. There were the fun years. Remember, I mean, from my first time getting high, whether it was a joint or a drink, from my first time getting high, I overshot the mark and I loved it. I remember the first time I smoked a joint, I said, "I'm going to do this forever." But then it got replaced by other more important stuff. And the same thing with drinking. I used to overshoot the mark with drinking. Every time I drank, I'd throw up. I was an embarrassment. I'm a terrible drinker. But I loved doing it, and I could. I'm going to moderate. I'm not going to get to that. I'm not going to cross that line. But it was so bad, I had to take medication. And that was cocaine. I never threw up again. For days. Right? So those were the good years, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict, as described in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, as a hopeless variety, and it talks about the different types in the doctor's opinion. I love this, and he talks about the type of alcoholic who's unwilling to admit he cannot drink, or the other type of alcoholic who's an addict who thinks that after a period of sobriety they can use safely, right? And then there's the ones they talk about, the manic depressive types, about which a whole chapter can be written. I wish they would have written it, because I don't know anything about that type. And then they talk about the ones who are normal in every respect except for their alcohol and drug use. That's not me. The other one that they mention is me. The psychopaths. That's me. They are always over remorseful, always making many resolutions, but never a decision. And that was me. I smoked crack at the end of my drinking. I smoked crack for about 8 years, and I never had a pipe. I used a can. Swear to God, when I talk, ashes would come out of my mouth. And here's why. You want to talk about a... Because every time I did, I'm going, this is the last time I'm doing this shit. Till tomorrow. And I remember throwing the can out and then having to circle back. Man. Trying to find... Or coming and driving home on the way after you just copped and looking for a can on the side of the road. The beer cans are great, but when you get these old soda cans and they're filled with ants, you know, you're... The adventures, right? The adventures of our lifestyle. But there were a lot of fun years in the drinking and drugging. It allowed me to do some things. It filled that hole in me that I didn't know I had. And I didn't think it was the alcohol or drugs. I thought it brought the real me out. And I was one of those guys that was going to go on to the bitter end because I can manage this. I can manage this. It's not, you know, it's not going to kick my ass again. And but one day, you don't know you can't stop until you can't stop, and you don't know that, or until you try. And I didn't. I had a lot of good years. I owned a bar on South Beach back when South Beach was just happening, you know. And I thought I was, you know, Don Johnson back then. Those were my Miami Vice period. And it was a lot of fun. But then one day, it just turned. And I end up living in motels. I remember when I really tried to stop. I was about 30 years old. I think I made my first feeble attempt at stopping. And said, that's it. You know, I'm going to straighten my life out. I ran into some old friends from school. They had cars and homes and families and jobs. Like real people. You know, I'm 30 years old, living in an apartment with three other guys, and our only furniture is those big wooden spools you find in the construction sites, you know. And there'll be a box of pizza crusts in the fridge, you know, with a sign written on it, touch this and you die. You know, and that's the way I was living at 30 years old, and what had happened to my life. So I tried to stop, tried to straighten out. I remember... And then I opened that bar on South Beach. That's not a good job for an alcoholic or a drug addict. And one of my, you know, have you ever seen the movie Scarface? Those guys used to drink in this bar. The real life characters in that movie. So it was every day I would go, towards the end I would go, you know, get ready to go down. It was a disco that was open. Disco is, for you young people, is a place where people used to dance. And I would go down, it would open at 11 at night till like 5 in the morning. And then I had the tiki bar that was out by the pool in the daytime. I would be coming down the elevator at night, man, and going, that's it. No matter what, tonight I am not going to get this engine started. I'm not taking a drink. And as soon as you walk in, it was called Joey's on the Ocean. So, you know, I had a self-esteem problem. as soon as you walk in, somebody says, hey, Joe, come on over, man. Here, take a bump. Or here, let's have a drink. And the next thing you know, you're off to the races. And it would be the next night or two nights later, coming down the elevator going, no matter what, tonight I am not going to start, man. I am not going to start. I eventually drank that bar into the ground and was living in motels. Things got really bad after that. I don't know exactly the day, but the corner got turned. And when I started living in motels, and now I'm really going to quit. I'm about 34 years old. I'm going to quit, and I mean it. But something terrible happened in my life. I heard all these terrible stories from all these guys. This was the worst thing that ever happened to me. My grandmother died and left me an inheritance. A lot of money. I can't quit now. Not now, right? This was enough money to change your life. Buy a car, buy a house, start a business, change your life. And she wasn't a rich person. She had 8 grandchildren. She worked as a school teacher, worked her way up to the board of education, saved every dime, and gave each one of her 8 grandchildren the same amount of money. They all used it wisely. Mine was gone in about 4 months. And because I said to myself that thing, I'm just going to do one more good binge, get it out of my system, and then I'm going to use this money and straighten my life out. And that binge lasted for about 4 months. And at the end of that 4 months, that's when it got really dark. I was living in Port St. Lucie, and we had a little baby. My girlfriend got pregnant. And back then, this is not how I feel today, and this is not a political statement or not for controversy, but back then I thought a stand-up guy would pay for an abortion. I don't think that that... don't feel that way today, but that's what I thought. And I gave her money to go get an abortion, and she was like me. She didn't spend the money on an abortion. And the next thing you know, we got a little baby coming, a little boy. And as crazy as it sounds, I thought maybe this little boy will make me sober up. Maybe, you know, some of us have tried other things to sober up. And I thought maybe this little boy will sober me up. And I remember I went to the hospital the day he was born. He was born right there in Port St. Lucie Hospital. I went to the hospital and walked in the nursery, held that little boy in my arms, and I fell in love with another human being for the first time in my life. It was like somebody flicked a switch in my life. I looked at that little boy and I held him and I made him all the promises that every dad would want to make his son. You're going to know you're loved. We're going to be able to walk down the street with our arms around each other. When we see each other, we're going to tell each other we love each other. I'm going to coach you in Little League and baseball and basketball and football. We're going to have so much fun together. And I meant it. I cried I held that little boy and cried. I'd never loved another human being like that in my life. And I put that little boy down in the nursery. And I walked into the waiting room. And there were guys like them. A few friends of mine there. And they went, hey, let's go have a drink to celebrate the birth of your son. 8 days later, I don't even know how they got home from the hospital. You know when they say no human power? I still didn't know this, but that's a manifestation of no human power. The greatest love in my life could not get me to show back up. And once I drink, that's what I do is I drink. Once I take a hit or smoke a rock or do a line or any, I'm one of the lucky ones, any substance I put in, I want more. It activates that phenomenon of craving we talk about. Now, so I had to go find a real job. I'm a father now, right? And I'm 36 years old, 37 years old. I've never had a real job in my life. I always work those jobs, pay you cash, so you could go out and spend that money at the end of the night. And I thought this meant being you were a self-starter. The next morning you would wake up broke, so you would have to go to work. And what happened was, is I'm looking in the paper. I said, what am I going to do? I'm not qualified. I look in the paper. I see a job perfect for me. It says, no experience necessary. I said, perfect. I'm qualified. This was in West Palm. So I go in and apply for the job. Now, this was back in the mid-80s. And a lot of you weren't there in the mid-80s. A lot of you weren't there in the mid-90s. Or, you know, you were probably born in, like, the 2000s, weren't they? So anyway, back then, there was a lot of drugs floating around. So they knew you did drugs. So they would send you for a polygraph, and they would do a urine test, and then they would run your credit. You know, my nose starts to run when I talk. I'm allergic to bullshit. So I went, they sent me for all this after my first interview. I come back from my second interview, and the manager's sitting there with all the reports. He's from the polygraph, the urinalysis, and he goes, holy cow, you lie, you do drugs, and you owe everybody in the world money. You're perfect. When can you start? That's when I started selling cars. It was a gift. I was a natural at it. And I remember my first month selling cars at West Palm Auto Mall. And my first month selling cars, the manager, you know, was kind of a character. And he'd say, all right, kid. He used to call me kid. And he was the same age as me. Kid, I'm going to make you my star. See all these guys out here? There were like 18 salesmen in this store. They're all going to hate you. I go, I already feel inferior enough. And at the end of the month, they had a big meeting, and they hand out commission checks. And there were all of the salesmen in the room, and I remember him. He called me, Joe Krogan, come on up, and he gave me a commission check. And he gives me a commission check for $7,500. I went, wow, my first legitimate job. What was I worried about? This stuff isn't that hard, right? And then he calls me up after, and he says, and a salesman of the month, and he hit all the bonuses. He calls me up again, another check for $4,500. If you're new, I'll do the math. It's 12 grand. So you don't have to spend the rest of the meeting trying to figure it out. You can go back to looking for her or him and judging the speaker, and, you know, like we do. And right? Did you find him? Now you can pay attention now? No. So he gives me these checks. My first month, salesman of the month, 12 grand. I left that dealership and I go up to the boss. I said, boss, I got to go show a car. I'll be back right after lunch. 16 days later. Now wait, that's not the crazy part. The crazy part is this. On day 16, I get up and put a shirt and tie on and go to work like nothing happened. They don't even know me. They don't even recognize me. Who is this guy? I was almost gone more than I was there. And the manager takes me in. He yells at me for a little while. And he says, great. He said, he cursed me out for about 40 minutes. He says, now get out there and sell a car. I went, oh, I love this job. I started making some money. But if you know, and I'm sure you do, or you wouldn't be sitting in this room. I love when people go to say they came to AA or NA or DAA, and they go, yeah, I came on my own. Nobody comes on their own, man. This is not on your bucket list of places to go to. This is gun to the head recovery. You got to be out of options, out of ideas, okay? I mean, I remember walking into my first meeting going, I wouldn't even drink with these people. You can keep the wolves away from the door if you're making good money for a while. But you can't make good money for a while. Sooner or later, your life is spiraling down. And we bought a little house in Port St. Lucie. I bought a car, established some credit, bought a car, and probably within a year and a half, 2 years, you know, hit losing one job, showing up for another. Because in sales, if you have a good reputation, they'll always give you another chance. As long as you don't kill the owner, they'll hire you back, you know. So, but I was running out of places to work, and they foreclosed on that house, repossessed the car, and I've got my little boy now. He's just about a year and a half old, and we snuck out of that house in the middle of the night in a $300 beater, you know, car that was just a piece of junk, and I didn't ever pay for it, too. They even repossessed my $300 car. We moved to that motel room in Fort Lauderdale, that Skid Row motel room in Fort Lauderdale, with my son and his mom. And that's where we spent the last 6 months, unemployed and unemployable. And it was hell. But I thank God for it. You know, some of the worst things that ever happened to us were some of the greatest lessons. I wouldn't be, Brian talked about it, you wouldn't be here. I had to take every drink, smoke every rock, do all those terrible things. You know, in AA we come in, and in NA we come in and we talk about, well, I didn't get sober to be a doormat. My problem is not being a doormat. My problem is making people doormats. I was always that guy. There were two types of people in this world. The ones whose backs I was stepping on to get to the ones whose asses I was kissing. And that's how I lived my life. It was just, if I knew you, I had to get something from you. I used to say, I know you, I owe you. And that's the way it was. We're in that motel room and things are getting really bad. But this is when, we were there for months. I move into a place, you can't get me out. The jaws of life can't get me out of there. You know, they had stickers on the door and they were going to call the sheriff. And finally, on the last day, I think it was the very last day, a miracle. This is where my best thinking took me. My best trying to figure out life. 40 years old, trying to make the... I never woke up one day in my life and said, today I'm going to burn my life to the ground. I always woke up and said, today I'm going to be as successful as I can be, even if it meant just getting a $20 piece or a six-pack. And just to get a buzz. And I discovered the problem in that motel room because I never knew what the problem was. And for the 4, 5, 6 months that I was there, I would go on binges. Anybody like binges? That's how I drank. I don't stop, I run out. I don't know how you do it. That's how I drink and drug. I never once said, has anybody got any Tupperware? I want to save this crack for tomorrow. That was never happening. It was, and I don't stop, I get caught. Something has to happen to stop me. And I would wake up, remember this? Maybe you can relate to this. They talk about alcoholic torture in the doctor's opinion. Well, I'll tell you what that looked like to me. It was not when I was drinking or drugging. The alcoholic torture is when I would crack my eyelids open after a binge. Remember that? And I would open my eyes and I'd go, damn, I'm not dead. Now, I wasn't suicidal, but I didn't want to wake up anymore in my life. And then the panic would set in because you'd look around and you'd go, damn, it's all gone. The booze is gone, the drugs are gone, the money's gone, the job's gone. One more time, it's all gone. And then I would do what I call the alcoholic dance. I would look at my little boy in that crib and I would cry real tears. He had filthy diapers. He had a bottle that used to have milk in it, but it was just cloudy water. And I would look at him. I'd say, that's it. I'm done. I'm going to straighten my life out. I'm going to be a dad. I'm going to pay the bills. I'm going to get some food in here. I'm going to change. Now, I'm going to change. And I don't understand what I'm doing. I don't understand. See, I thought you had to want to stop to stop. I didn't know. I never wanted to stop. I don't know why you came here, but I did not come here because I wanted to stop smoking crack. No, that's not. And I realized that on September 12th is my sobriety date, but I don't remember a lot about September 12th. I remember a hell of a lot about September 11th. And on September 11th, I woke up and did that crack my eyelids open. Damn, I'm not dead. Then it's all gone. The booze gone. The drugs gone. Jobs, everything's gone. One more time. Look at my little boy. Cried real tears. And here's what happened. To that point was my best effort. What my best effort had done with my life. And from this moment on, this is what God's done with my life. I looked at my little boy and I cried in his filthy diapers and his watered down milk in that crib. And I said, that's it. I'm going to turn my life around. And there was a voice inside my head that said, no, you're not. And I couldn't buy the lie one more day. I didn't want to stop. Matter of fact, I understood the problem that day. See, I had been waking up and treating my illness like a non-alcoholic would treat it. See, a non-alcoholic would wake up in that motel room and go, Jesus, that's it. I'm out of here. I'm paying the bills, getting a job, straightening my life out, becoming a dad. If I could have done those things, I would have. Our book says we had a moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them. I kept waking up, making many resolutions, but never a decision. I couldn't live up to them. I had the needed power wasn't there. And that day, I knew it for the first time. And I finally made a decision that changed my life. And this was the day before my sobriety date. And the decision I made was, because I said, I'm never going to wake up feeling guilt, shame, and remorse anymore. I know I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. I'm going to die this way. And I said, I'm going to do whatever it takes to drink and drug until I die. And I'm going to quit quitting. No more am I going to wake up and say, I'm done. I went full steam ahead, and I didn't care anymore. There was nothing going to hold me back on that day. And let me tell you what happened. God showed up in that motel room. and he was fat and bald. He was my brother. There was a knock on that motel room door that night, and I was sitting there on September 11th in a stupor. My little boy was being ignored in the filthy diapers and with that watered down milk because I couldn't look at him. I couldn't stand the pain. And I understood what my problem was that day. My problem was not alcohol or drugs. My problem was not enough alcohol or drugs. See, the alcohol and drugs worked. I just couldn't stay high. I had to sober up. And when you sober up, the wasted life was on me. And it was so bad. That's alcoholic torture. That was the alcoholic torture. That's what I wanted to escape. If I could have just stayed drunk and high, I'd have been okay. And that night there was a knock on that motel room door. Now, I don't know about you guys or how you use, but at this point in your drinking, you do not open the door, okay? There's tape on the peephole. No light can escape. But, right? But that night, I got over in my stupor and I opened the door without even looking. And I know why. And I, for years, I thought about it after I got sober. I go, why did I do that? I mean, and I know why today. Because I didn't have to hide anymore. I knew I was an alcoholic and an addict. And I wasn't pretending to be something I'm not. There was no fear anymore. And I knew Publishers Clearing House was not outside that door with the balloons going, hey, man, we got the big check. My life was over as I know it, and I didn't care. And my brother walked in, and he didn't lecture me. I believe this was divine. He said the only thing that would have got my attention. You know, it talks about it in our book. It says, what seemed at first a flimsy reed proved to be the loving hand of God. When you get here, if you're like me, and some of you know what this is like, your life's hanging by a thread. That's that flimsy reed. And we come and we go, and the chances are improbable that it won't break. But we come, and guess what happens? We start doing this stuff. We don't believe in it, but that string doesn't break. Your life's hanging by a thread. That thread doesn't break. And that night was that flimsy reed. He didn't come in. He didn't lecture me. He didn't say, because it wouldn't have worked. Did any that ever work on any of us? No. Advice ever work on anybody? No. Yet go to our meetings. That's all you hear is advice. Like it's going to work. So he walked in, and I could see the horror in his eyes. And he didn't say anything. But he looked at me, and he put his phone number down, and he said, if you want help, I will watch your son while you get help. And that was the only thing I believe he could have said. That last thread was my son. Because I knew the ship was going down. I just wanted somebody to take my son. Because I didn't care anymore what was going to happen to me. And it was going to get there. I couldn't keep the lie alive anymore. And the next day is September 12th. I woke up and I made that phone call. I didn't want to stop. I just didn't want him to die. I wanted to die, or at least I wanted to use until I didn't know I was dead. Because at the end, I used to pray, please, let this hit be the one that stops my heart. Please don't let me wake up. And I'm not a white wine spritzer alcoholic. And I've found out that I'm not a white wine spritzer. I can't do white wine spritzer recovery either. And I found that out the hard way. I still didn't have, I had no idea what AA was or NA or any meetings or detox or treatment. But the next day I called, I had heard about treatment centers. So I said, all right, I'll do treatment. And I had heard there was a couple old musicians that had gone to treatment and now were playing music. And they'd straighten their lives out. I said, I'll go to treatment. Now I'm looking for the treatment center, you know, with the Olympic pool and the weight room. And, you know, this is down in Miami. I knew it was 28 days or 30 days. A little sun, I'll be fine. I'll be back on my feet. You know, equine therapy. They had equine therapy at my treatment center, too. They told you, you're a horse's ass, is what they told you. That was their equine therapy. And it was a treatment center for indigents, for homeless people. And it was a six-month treatment center. And I remember the night I got there was my 40th birthday. It was September 17th. And I was standing outside with the rest of the guys. There were all young guys in there. I was the oldest guy in the treatment center trying to be cool. Right? Trying to be the coolest guy in the treatment center. Yeah, what a fool. Right? I used to go, I'd talk to these young guys. I owned a bar on South Beach. They used to call me Miami Joe. Nobody called me Miami Joe. I called me Miami Joe. You're really pitiful when you got to give yourself a nickname. Right? But we're standing outside, and we're not vaping. We're smoking, okay? And this kid pulls up. He was 27 years old. He gets out of the car, and he's got nice pressed pants, and he's got a collared shirt on. And it's Friday night in Miami. Now, I know Miami. I love Miami. There's a lot of places I'd be in Miami, but in the hood in a treatment center. This treatment center was in the hood because I used to buy crack right around the corner. He gets out of his car, and I think he's going to have a class. We're going to have a class. I don't know what he's doing there. And he comes in, and I'm looking at him, sizing him up, and I'm going, man, I bet I could do this gig. I wonder what they're paying him. But he had, and we always say in meetings, that if you want what we have, well, he had what I wanted. He had a wristwatch and a full pack of Marlboro Reds. But if I could get my hands on those, I'll be out of here. And he's in a nice car, and I don't recognize what he's doing, but he's holding an AA meeting. And he said some things in there that I didn't agree with. He said, you never have to take another drink or drug again if you don't want to. Well, I knew that was crap because I had not wanted to for a long time. I was drinking against my will. Once I start, that's it. And then he said a couple other things. He said one thing, and this was my 40th birthday, and I thought it was the worst day of my life. I had died and gone to hell. And he said, this got my attention. He said, you never have to feel the way you feel tonight again. And I would have given anything for that. There were 50 people in that treatment center, all indigents, homeless, or out of prison. And I would have traded lives with any one of them that night. I would have been anybody else but me. He said, there's 50 of you here. At the end of the 6-month period, there won't be 5 of you left. And he was right. There wasn't 5 of us left. Our chances are less than average. And I didn't know. And I'm going to tell you, maybe my story is a little different than most people's stories. But, the guilt, it's easy to be remorseful in the back of a cop car. How many people know that, right? When you're handcuffed in the back of a cop car, it's easy. Oh, I swear I'll never do it again. But the problem with remorse, I thought it meant something. It's got zero effect on stopping. As a matter of fact, it's got an expiration date. Sometimes it's only a few hours. Sometimes it's only a few minutes. As soon as they let me out of that cop car, it's like, whew, that was close. Right? Now, where can I get a hit? Where can I get a drink? So that guilt, shame, and even says that in our book. And I hate these guys that quote pages, but on the top of page 24, it says, there comes a time in our drinking where the strongest desire to stop, or drugging, where the strongest desire to stop is of absolutely no avail. See, I thought being remorseful accounted for something. It doesn't. It's actually in the way. It doesn't count for anything. And it has no effect on my stopping. I ended up getting out of that treatment center, like I told you, and I went to the only place I knew where my mom was, in Central Florida. And I moved into their... they had a manufactured home. For those of you that don't know, it's kind of like halfway between a trailer and a house. I call it Mom's Halfway House. I needed a job, and I had nowhere else to go. They had put my son up and my girlfriend up in an apartment, but I couldn't go back to her because she was actively using. But I was close enough where I could come and get my son every day and spend time with him. I ended up getting a job, going for a job. I applied for a job at a car dealership in town. I'm waiting to talk to the general manager, and he invites me in his office. Who do you think it is? It's the friggin' guy that gave me that $12,000 check 4 years earlier. Wow. And he had known what had happened, and he says, "All right, I'll." He gave me a chance, and he hired me. But I'm so new, I don't know. And I'm sitting in my mom's front stoop, smoking, not vaping. And all of a sudden, this old man is next door and he's watering his lawn. And I can see him kind of working his way over. I'm going, the neighborhood pedophile. Except I'm not a kid, right? And he comes working his way over. He goes, hey, my name's Frank. How are you? I go, hi, Frank. He said, would you like to go to a meeting tonight? I go, Mom's been talking. And he said, yeah, sure. It's either that or stay home and watch Murder, She Wrote with Mom. So he says, I'll pick you up at 6:45. At 6:45, I looked out the window, and there was that little car running and this old man behind the wheel. Let me tell you how old he was. He was 4 years younger than I am today. That's how old he was. He had nothing I wanted. They say, if you have what... He had nothing I wanted. He was driving a Buick, married to the same woman for 50 years, raised 5 kids, living in a retirement community. This guy's got nothing. I'm Miami Joe. I'm going to bust out of here sooner or later, right? You know, we go from unemployed to underpaid in about a month when we get sober. And, you know, now I can get back on my feet. Now that I'm sober, I can do one more good drug deal to get set up financially for sobriety. You know, I sucked at drug dealing, man. So I remember they asked me in that polygraph thing, said, have you ever made any money through the sale of illegal drugs? I said, no, I always lost money. That's the truth. I wanted to be truthful, you know. I just wanted the job, so I wanted to tell the truth. And so Frank comes and picks me up, never beeps, never gets out of the car, never beeps a horn, never comes to the door. He sat there patiently waiting. I went out, I got in the car, we drove off to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he took me in that meeting, and this is, like I told you, it's a retirement community. There were 50 people in that meeting. They were all, you couldn't put together a whole set of teeth from the people in that meeting. And they would, if you want what we have, and there was the old lady in that meeting, oh, we have so much fun in sobriety. We go to picnics and dances. I'm going, oh, God, kill me now. And because I know when you're new, if you're new, sobriety isn't all that attractive, man. Right? I mean, let me just mention one statement. Pay back the money. Jesus. Who wants to do that? Right? Sobriety looks to me like you're on a train and is pulling into the next stop, and at that train station that it's the end of the line, the train's going to stop, are all the people you don't want to see. Your ex-girlfriends, your bosses, your kids, the judges, the police, the IRS. I hadn't paid income tax in 20 years. So who wants to get sober? I just didn't want that torture anymore. And I kind of went through with this treatment thing, and next thing you know, I got 6 months, and I still don't have any kind of program or sobriety, but I learned to ride in the front seat of that car with Frank. Frank was not a big book thumper. Frank was a big book liver. He lived that book, and everywhere we went, man, and he took me through those steps and taught me this program and helped me work through those steps. And I remember step one, he taught me, it was a very simple, he goes, you're a bright guy, you're Miami Joe, you know, so I'm going to tell you step one in a way you can understand it. Here's step one, you're screwed. He goes, that's it. I go, holy cow. Well, that's not good news. He goes, step one's not good news. Okay, it's not. You're screwed. If you're not 100% convinced you will drink again and use again, you will use again. And I was like, wow, that sounds like algebra or something. But he's right. See, that was the only thing I did know, is that when they let me out of that 6-month treatment center, I in the back of my head, I wanted to stay sober, but I wonder how long before I screw up. I wonder how long. I've always screwed up. I'm a screw up. I hope I stay sober, but, you know, there's a great line that I heard one time by a wise man. He says, most evil is done by men who have neither committed to do good nor evil. And I didn't understand. The first surrender is to surrender to your disease. The second surrender is to surrender to the program. And that's the big one. Because I don't like the control that it looks like. So I told Frank, well, if I'm going to drink again, I mean, that sucks. And I'm going to use again. It sounds like it's going to take a friggin' miracle. He says, that's step two. Which it is. He says, so Let's hope for one, okay? And let's start acting like one might be coming. So that's step three. And we did our step three on our knees. I did step three with my sponsor. But after that's as far as I was going to go. Step four, you don't understand. If you're sitting in this room and you're an alcoholic and an addict of my type, I know what you did. I know what you did at 4 a.m. when nobody was looking. When you were dying for somebody to validate you or for another hit. I know what you did because I did it. I did things I'm never going to let see the light of day. And that step, Frank lived right next door, and I was in my mom's house. They had gone back up north. This was their winter home. And I had that whole side of the house, the blinds drawn so tight it looked like a crack house. No light could escape. And by this time, I had gotten a little car, and I would come home, and I would turn the engine off and the lights off and coast into the driveway so the lights wouldn't fan across his house, and he would see me. Because he'd say, well, let's do step four. I'm not doing step four. And then I would peek out the blinds, and when his car was gone, I would call his house and leave a message on his answering machine. An answering machine is a little box that used to record your voice. And I would say something like this, Frank, where the hell are you? I want to do this step four. Click. Right? I make it look like it's him. But it says in our book, the alcoholic insanity returns and then we drink. So my problem is not the drinking or drugging. It's the insanity and the pain of this insane life. I need something to keep the lie and the delusion in place. And it got so bad, eventually I did a fourth step with Frank. But it wasn't a causes and conditions fourth step. That came later. And I made amends and paid off the IRS, made a deal with the IRS, got rid of the felonies that I had when I got here. I had some felonies. I got custody of my son after 11 months, and I became a single dad and raised my son. And life started to happen, started to get good. But the problem when it gets good is I think these are the promises coming true in my life. You know, I'm that guy, you heard the story about the guy praying for a parking space. Oh, I'm late for this appointment. And I drove around the building. There's no parking space. I got to get in there. And he drives around. There's no park. Please, God, let me find a parking space. He circles one more time and a car pulls out right in front. He pulls in. Never mind, God, I found one. That's me. I got this, God. Don't worry. I don't know why I was so worried. Things are great. And I started to get promoted, and I met a girl. Right? I met this woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. We fell madly in love. She had two kids. I had my son. You could hear the suction across the room in the meeting. Right? And we ended up having a torrid relationship. Ended up getting married. And now I'm getting promoted, and I'm kind of thinking these are the promises. And I uproot this entire family, and we move back down to West Palm. We're living up in Central, but we move back down to West Palm, Florida. Because I got the best job offer I've ever had in my life. Making more money ever dreamt of. Well, what's happened is that I'm not really in recovery. I'm coming home, and I'm putting up the cardboard cutout of a husband. I look like I'm there. I'm checking boxes, but I'm not there, and I think I'm fooling them. And I'm putting the cardboard cutout of a dad. And then I'm not qualified for this job, so I'm putting a cardboard cutout up at work. And sooner or later, the whole thing starts spiraling. I come home one day, my wife says, I want a divorce. This is the way it's going to be. I want out. And divorce me. I end up leaving with my little boy. And the last thing she said to me as I'm walking out the door is, can't you see all your relationships end the same? And I couldn't, and I didn't hear that then. And then I was so angry and so upset that eventually they find out I'm putting the cardboard cutout at work, and they fire me from my job. And I'm 5.5, 6 years sober, and I'm unemployed. I got fired. My wife just divorced me because I would go into places I shouldn't be going and hiding money from her just in case this thing doesn't work out. See, my philosophy about a good relationship is 50-50, but I'm keeping score. Okay. Bad. You can't. It's like being at bat, calling your own balls and strikes. Can't do it. And the next thing you know, I'm so angry that I want to drink. and I'm not going to meetings. She got custody of AA when we got divorced. She's a member of AA. You know, I know I'm walking into meetings, they're going, there's that scumbag. I can feel him thinking it. And so I stopped going to meetings. I'm not sober. I'd stopped a while. And I'm not drinking or drugging, but I'm not sober. I'm not spiritually fit. And eventually I passed this bar, and it caught my attention. And I said, if I go back out, I'm going to drink in that place. And I circled that bar like a buzzard for 7 days. And on day seven, I left my little boy asleep in that apartment. We had that little furnished studio apartment, and I got in my car and I cursed God. I said, if this is sobriety, you can have it. And I drove across town to that bar. It was on US 1 in Lake Worth. And it had a name that really caught my attention. It said Bar. And I knew I could be a big shot in there for a little while, right? And what happened was, is I'm a block away from that bar. And I could see the bar, and I got the butterflies in my stomach. And I look over this way while I'm at the red light, and there's a broken down van with its hood up. And I could see its front license plate, and it said, have you prayed today? And I said the serenity prayer. I don't know why. And I didn't go to that bar that night. I drove across town to a meeting I'd been to one time a year earlier, and I walked in, and there were more people there than there are here. And I sat in the back of the room, and the guy was at the podium, and he said, tonight's anniversary night. We're celebrating anniversaries. Is there anyone here with an anniversary in the month of September? Well, like an idiot, I raised my hand. And everybody clapped. And he says, well, here's what we do. We have 5 or 6 people celebrating. They all come up for about 5 minutes, tell how they stayed sober. Since we have a visitor, why don't you start us off? No, it wasn't funny. It wasn't. And I got up to the front of the room, and I turned around, and I looked out, and I saw all your faces. One more time, the kindness of strangers, because most of us are here because of the kindness of strangers. And I couldn't talk. All I could do was cry. And then all I could do was sob. And I just stood there, and I finally got the words out of my mouth, said, I'm lost. I don't know how to do this thing. I need help. And 2 guys rushed me off the stage. I found out why, because the treatment center had brought the bus, and they were all in the front row. And I could hear him in the back of, at 6 years sober, right? He goes, that's not how it is at 6 years. He's just humble. No. And I'll briefly tell you what it's like now in my life. I went back through and I did the steps and I found out the causes and conditions. And I had a spiritual awakening. And I changed the way I looked at life, that new attitude. And see, after step 9, we think the steps are kind of like boot camp in the military. When you're done with boot camp, you're in shape. You're ready for service. That's what the steps are. They render you ready for service. Your military obligation isn't done after boot camp. It's just starting. And that's what happens when we get through these steps. And so I had a whole new attitude. They started taking me to detoxes and treatment centers. And I started sponsoring guys. And my life changed. And about a year later, a year and a half later, I met my wife at a convention. And we started dating again. And we said, if we're going to date, I'm powerless over marriage, so we're going to have God's help. Just like with the alcohol. And today we do our meditation separately, and then we take some time and we pray together every morning for our marriage. Even the days we don't want to pray together. There's times my wife, I'll go, we have a fight, I pull out the calculator. How far can I get on half? Wonder what the going price of a kilo is today. I found out it's 30 grand. Just for resource. I mean, just a reference, that's all. But my kid, my little boy, I took that little boy and we rented a little house together, and I took a crummy job for the first time in my life. I took a job based on someone else's welfare, not my own, not to get a better job. I got off the merry-go-round. I was 47 years old. I stopped trying to be a success. All I wanted to be was a good dad and a good member of my Alcoholics Anonymous group. And I coached that little boy in basketball, baseball, and football. And it was the best time of our lives. And I changed my attitude towards work. And I went to work as a service. It talks about it in the 12 and 12. When we can use our jobs as a means of giving service. And my life has changed. And when I did that, I took a crummy job so I could take my son to school in the morning and pick him up from school at night. I became willing to work at a gas station or a 7-Eleven. And I took a crummy job. And guess what happened? I fell in love with that crummy job. And since I've been 47 years old, I've never had to work another day in my life because I love what I do today. It's amazing when we stop fighting and we surrender to this thing. I'll close with one quick story, and I love it because it happens in Miami. When I used to close my bar down in Miami, I had my little entourage in my bar, and we'd leave, and we'd go to this after-hours club. It was the best after-hours club in the world. If you've never been there, too bad, it's too late. It was awesome. You ring the doorbell, they slide the little door open, and they would look out. If they recognized you, you would get in. Now, they knew me because I owned a bar in town, and so they would let me in, and we'd all go in. There would be 500 people in this place. No windows. Everybody's dressed. The limos are lined up out front. No signage. You know, I mean, you don't know this. It's all blacked out windows outside. People were getting shot and stabbed in this place, and they throw out the stabbee, not the stabber. You know, because they don't want them bleeding on people, right? It was the greatest place in the world, but here's what made it great. At about 11 o'clock in the morning on Sunday morning, they would open the door because they would close. Now, it's Sunday morning, Miami Beach, 11 o'clock, and you know the sun is brilliant, and you're still in your disco clothes from about 3 days. But they would give you a full glass of whatever it is you drank. And I drank scotch. They'd give me a full glass of scotch, and they would give you cardboard sunglasses. They thought of everything. And one day I'm walking out of this place, cardboard sunglasses, cigarette hanging out of my mouth, full glass of scotch. I get in my car and I drive to the light, and I'm at the traffic light at the next corner. And I look over, and next to me is this little car, just an unassuming little car. And in the front seat is a guy in a white shirt, short sleeve white shirt and tie. And next to him is a woman with her hair all done up in a nice, pretty dress. And in the back seat, there's a little boy and a little girl dressed identical to the mom and dad in the front seat. Now, you know where they're going or coming from on Sunday morning, right? And I look over with my cardboard sunglasses and go, what a bunch of losers. And I'm sure that little boy looked over at me and went, hey, Dad, look, it's the Antichrist. But today, because of a program of recovery that I found in here, because of the men that I got to walk behind and follow, because of a loving God that I found in this program and through the 12 steps, I'm in that car today. Thank you for letting me be here. All right, a couple quick announcements.